We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. The Afternoon Magazine is part of Illinois Public Media, WILL, AM 580, FM 90.9, HD2, online at will.illinois.edu. People left behind in the wake of a suicide are bereft and grieving. They may also feel guilt and shame. Nancy Rappaport's mother took her life when her daughter was 4 years old. Today, Nancy Rappaport is a psychiatrist who, in her words, helps people navigate agony and fortify their determination to forge ahead. Dr. Nancy Rappaport has written a book examining suicide and her mother's death. The title, In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. Nancy's mother's name was also Nancy. Nancy Vahey Rappaport Stanley. She took her life in 1963. She left behind her husband, an ex-husband, and six children. Our guest was the youngest. Dr. Rappaport delves into her mother's suicide in the book, looking at it from the perspective of a daughter, a psychiatrist, wife, and mother of three children. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Nancy Rappaport is assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. She's also director of school-based programs in child psychiatry at the Cambridge Health Alliance. You'll find her online at www.nancyrappaport.com. R-A-P-P-A-P-O-R. Dr. Rappaport's book, In Her Wake, is published by Basic Books. Again, the phone numbers, if you'd like to join our discussion this afternoon, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Dr. Rappaport, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's a joy to be here.
Your mother seems to have been a pretty remarkable woman. She had six children. She worked outside the home. She was active in the community and had entered politics. What else would you like to tell us about her?
Well, an important part, because she has appearances in the book, is that she was a writer, which I didn't know until about 4 years ago, when her best friend had kept a trunk, which I didn't know about, and I received it, and in it was a novel that she'd been writing at the time of her death. And so there are parts of my book where I include some of her writings, and certainly as a psychiatrist, this was a brain trust to be able to see that aspect of its chapter 3.
Yeah.
And as a daughter, learning about her, how she felt, was very meaningful.
With that novel were some notes that she had made about the process of writing it. That was also revealing.
Yes, because she worried about being exposed and the trepidation of not wanting to write something that was mediocre. I mean, wanting to make it be a good book. And I certainly felt very similar. I am an assistant professor and have spent my professional career writing about violence and aggression in kids and how to intervene and school consultation, and taking on a journey to be transparent with the reader about my own loss and how I move towards healing. I could appreciate her vulnerability.
Hmm. What inspired you to write this book? Because it is so personal.
this book chose me in a way. There's often people talk about with suicide that there's silent grief, and I had a unique opportunity as a psychiatrist to be able to ask questions of people who have survived, like my father or my siblings, and the doctor who took care of my mother when she was in a coma, my mother's, the man that she had an affair with while she was married to my father. And my training probably allowed me to tolerate both the curiosity and the fear of finding out the answers. And another big aspect, and I would say this for any of your listeners, that often when we have our children, we look back at our past and try to make sense of it so we can forge a future with our children. And when my daughter, my oldest daughter's 19 now, when she was first born and I was holding her in my arms, I found myself asking the question, the mystery of how could my mother have left us, because I had such a profound sense of connection to this baby in my arms, and that's what I needed to figure out.
Hmm. At the end of the first chapter, you say, suicide demands to be explained by the living as a way to absolve or condemn the survivors. You also say this, I have tried to create a meaningful narrative to understand what happened, recognizing that the truth is buried with the victim and that questions will always linger. A couple of questions come to mind upon reading that. Why does suicide demand to be explained by the living? And how is a meaningful narrative of suicide created?
First of all, you read those words so beautifully. You have a wonderful way of reading it, Celeste. Suicide demands an explanation because for many of us who have survived a suicide, it's sudden and unexpected. And the person who leaves us self-inflicted a wound. So you're left in a confusion, and that's why I think it demands an explanation. And it sometimes can wreak havoc in a family because you look to blame other people or you punish yourself for what's happened. And in my situation, my mother overdosed after a custody battle with my father that had gone on for 2 years, and she was supposed to be getting her children back on the day she took the overdose. And they were a prominent couple in Boston, my mother being involved with politics, my father being involved both in politics and development. And the custody battle was covered very closely over that 2 year period. So I had grown up not really having us talk much about the suicide. It was. I grew up with a blended family of 11 children, and it was just not part of the fabric of who we were. And I think many times that can happen in families where we're not exactly sure how to talk about this kind of profound loss. And quite frankly, oftentimes the surviving parent understandably wants us all to move on. So when I say suicide demands an explanation, it's that we all will try to make sense of that loss. And sometimes the way we make sense can be damaging. So I describe how even at 4 years old that I had somewhat magical thinking and had this idea that somehow I must have caused my mother's suicide. And that developmentally is how you are when you're a four-year-old. You think the whole world revolves around you. But that was faulty logic. And I was fortunate enough as I got older to be able to work through some of that confusion with a therapist. But it's that's what I'm trying to get across, is to take my story and to use it as a learning tool to allow the reader to not only be thinking about suicide, but how do we make meaningful narrative of things that have happened in our past.
Yeah. What advice do you have for survivors of suicide loss who have not yet come to terms with what happened? Where does one begin?
With a tremendous amount of compassion towards themselves. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes I think survivors will blame themselves and have mixed emotions. And sometimes the mixed emotions can be very confusing. They can have anger, rejection, abandonment. And being able to recognize that the whole range of emotions are completely understandable. And other times, people who have survived a loss in a family will ask themselves, well, what if? You know, what if I hadn't had that fight the night before, or had, you know, driven by the town? And there's an overestimate of their contributing role to the suicide. And the other aspect, if it can be useful to find out if their family member did have a mental illness, because many times in 80 to 90% of completed suicides, there is mental illness, and that can help you understand that the fight at the dinner table might have been a culminating, you know, might have been overwhelming for that patient, but I mean for the family member, but it's very complicated in some ways how suicide happens. Many people who are depressed don't go on to kill themselves. And so I would say both being compassionate, asking for help, and understanding from those they love, and being able to tolerate that many family members can have different responses, and definitely getting help from a mental health professional if they start to have flashbacks or symptoms of PTSD, for example, if they found their loved one hanging or any of the other, you know, or with a gunshot wound. These can be very difficult moments. Clearly, if they have suicidal thoughts or plans, they want to make sure that they get help. And being able to allow themselves to explore some of the troubling aspects of their relationship with the deceased person. Sometimes you can either kind of idealize the person who has left you or demonize them, and trying to find a middle road is what I would encourage people to do. Mm-hmm. That was my task.
Yeah.
Middle road.
Middle road. In my introduction, I mentioned that, you know, people who survive, they may feel guilt and shame, and we've talked a little bit here about the guilt. Is shame a result of the guilt?
It's a great question. The shame comes in a lot of different ways. The shame may come in a sense that you somehow have been tainted by this happening with what we talked about, the guilt. Certainly that if you caused it, then you feel shame, even if it's highly unlikely that you caused it. And the shame, I also think, particularly in children, is there can be a sense that or worry that suicide is contagious. And I talk about that. Mm-hmm. We know with children who have had parents that have killed themselves, they are 5 times more likely to kill themselves. But it's important when you have children that have experienced this to also couch that, because there are factors that contribute to it. So if a child who's had sexual abuse, physical abuse, and has lost a parent to suicide, that makes them more vulnerable. Or if they have untreated mental illness, substance abuse. So in some ways, you can turn it around and you can say to a child like that, you know what, you have a vulnerability, just like you put a seatbelt on when you drive, you probably want to stay away from substance abuse, using substances. Mm. So it doesn't have to terrorize you like it's a predetermined ending.
Now, this is interesting because there were some experiences and events that your mother went through in her childhood that may have played a part in your mom's development. In fact, I would say did play a role in
Absolutely.
Your mom's development. The alcoholism of her parents and the death of your mother's younger sister, Judy, at the age of 4. How old was your mother at the time of her sister's death?
She was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And again, that was part of my investigative work. I didn't know much at all about my mother's childhood. There weren't any relatives that were alive that could tell me about it. And that story came because my first stepmother had said there was a man who was a married people in one of the Newton town. And I called him, and I called him on my 45th birthday, and he answered the phone, and he said to me, I have been waiting 40 years for this phone call. And he had been my grandmother's, on my mother's side, confidant when he was, so she'd have been about 90 at the time now. He was 65. He was a confidant from, you know, when he was about 12 until he was 19. And he was the person who could give me the details of what had happened with the death of my aunt. And then I went and got the newspaper report that described it in more detail.
Yeah. One of the things that I was really struck by, and you write about this, you use this as a metaphor a number of times in the book, in her wake, family as scaffolding, sisters and brothers. Sisters and brothers, you write, provide scaffolding for our emerging sense of who we are. So this death of Judy had to have been very important, very critical in her.
Absolutely.
In
what
her
I
life.
Was trying, I didn't mean to cut you off, excuse me. What I was trying to do for the reader is sometimes in research they talk about with a suicide that they go back and they do a psychological autopsy, which is basically talking to multiple people and trying to understand the precipitating events. So I don't do this academically. I was passionate to figure this out. It was so important to me. And that aspect of what it must have been like for her to lose her sister in a tragic way, where she probably felt a fair amount of guilt. She was home with her sister, and her sister drowned in a small pond. So, you know, I don't know where my mother was during that episode. So there was this also strange sense of understanding how my mother might have lived with a sense of guilt. And then it made me also understand that the prospect of losing her children, how that must have been amplified, because she only had one sister that she lost, and they never had another one, and she had six kids in pretty quick succession. And the sense that she couldn't protect her children, she has that very moving description that I had, you know, 40 years later, problems of a long-distance mother. And many times her story was heart-wrenching. And yet I never wanted to discourage the reader. I wanted them to know that I was a narrator that survived and was tenacious and could tolerate pursuing this wake, and that it would give me added strength and would also allow me to ask my patients to do something which I could appreciate with my own journey, how hard it is to ask yourself these tough questions and try to find out answers.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today is Nancy Rappaport. Her mother took her life when her daughter was 4 years old. Today, Nancy Rappaport is a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist. She's written a book examining suicide and her mother's death. The title, In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. There were some moments in this book, Dr. Rappaport, where you had me holding my breath for you. I thought, she is really out there and brave to conduct this particular interview. So, but anyway, I want to go back to the idea of, you mentioned working your work with patients. First of all, do you think your mother's death led you into the career you're in today?
I would assume so.
Yeah.
And I hope I have enough self-reflection to answer this in a fair way. I'm always cautious in one way because I love child psychiatry. It's an incredible opportunity to intervene with kids and families and provide support. And I can't say, because I'm the person I am, whether I would have chosen another field had I not lost my mother. But I do know that it's tremendously satisfying to work with teenagers who may be suicidal and see them turn around and that just be a a shift that becomes part of their history, but not their defining moment. And I love working with schools. I love providing for teachers and helping them understand some concepts that might be useful. So the part I'm cautious about is I would never want a patient of mine to feel that I want them to stay alive because I couldn't save my mother. I want them to know I want them alive because they are valuable. And when you're working with a patient that's depressed and particularly suicidal, they have the mistaken thought that they're expendable. And I know that's not true because I've worked with schools and families that have lost loved ones to suicide, and that is an enormous loss. And we are all loved, and that's one of the messages that I'm trying to get across to my readers, is how important each one of us is.
Yeah. When you're working with young people, how do you get them to try and talk about where they are and describe where they are and the kind of pain that they're in?
Well, I don't know if this is so polite to say, but sometimes people say working with teenagers is just like working with wild animals. You can't look right at them. You have to be very present and not demanding. And in a curious way, you have to sort of also roll over and play dead, where you give them, within the therapeutic relationship, you let them know that they are calling the shots, that it's their choice when they want to reveal what they want to reveal. And you stay curious with them so that, now you have to make sure they're going to, you know, if they're going to leave and go take a talk about taking a fatal overdose, you have to intervene and make them safe while you're having those kind of discussions and hospitalize them. But some of these kinds of discussions I couldn't have with my own children, because you can't be curious about with your own family members about why it would be that they would think that death is a viable alternative or suicide. But when you're working clinically, you can ask questions like, well, have you ever thought about what it would be like for your mother to be at a funeral that, you know, where she was burying her son? And try to get them to be forward thinking about the magnitude of the loss. Or you can do other things where you really try to have them take inventory of what are the things that they do well, how can they build a sense of hope. And that's what you're in. You're in a tug of war where you don't want to be so invested that they in them staying alive that they can become increasingly negative. It's a balancing act. It's a tightrope. It's a delicate dialogue that can be life-saving. And then, of course, you're also doing a differential diagnosis where you're trying to figure out, is this a biological component where there may be medications that can alleviate some of the pain, major depression, bipolar? Is this trauma-based? Can you help with the thought processes that sometimes can derail them?
In the book, you write about working with a girl by the name of Ellen, a young woman. And it was interesting to see how you worked with her in her silences.
Well, she's terrific. She had a lot of silences, and it was so sweet. She loved that piece. I changed the name and sort of made a little bit of different things. But sometimes you have to be patient with teenagers. And we all know this as parents. You know, it's the very moment that you are you feel least available that your child chooses to talk to you. And similarly, as a therapist, sometimes it's a waiting game, and you might spend a lot of time hearing about a rap star or their favorite hobby, and you're wondering to yourself, you know, what I really should be talking about is the fact that they have a boyfriend that's not good to them, or that they're being promiscuous, or a whole variety, or they're failing school. But they sometimes are going to, they're just, they're sizing you up, and you're giving them an opportunity to size you up. So oftentimes when I start working with a teenager, I'm going to tell you all my tricks, and then the next teenager I have is going to blow it. But you want to allow them to let you into their world. And the remarkable, I've been working with teenagers for 18 years, is when you find a capacity for teenagers to be self-reflective, usually they start to make good choices. Mm. That's the exciting part.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. We're going to go first to Charleston, Illinois, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hello. I caught this conversation in this show. I have an interesting statement more so than a question concerning the intervention of a therapist in cases where, let's say, a young adult, adolescent is threatening suicide or even the ideation of such. How has it played out with the guest putting a spanner in the works, if you will, as far as the trust is concerned in this therapeutic situation? How does one justify incarceration with teenagers, and how does that play out in long-term trust and outcome in the patient? Thank you.
It's a beautiful question, because what you're asking about the fundamental question of rights for all of us around the choice to live or die. And my experience clinically is that when patients have talked with doctors about wanting to die, it's often because they have an ambivalence. And when I don't see it as incarceration when you hospitalize a patient, although I can understand that sometimes it can feel very damaging and insulting. I take it very seriously when you take a patient out of being in school and doing all the normative things that you want a student to be doing. And so I really only do it in desperate times when I'm worried about imminent harm, immediate harm, where you have to slow things down and allow for a pause for self-reflection and a chance to really examine what has gotten to this point where I have to worry that this patient's going to walk out and drink ammonia or walk in front of a car or hang themselves. So I only hospitalize in very urgent situations where it can be life-saving.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line 1. Hi.
Hello. Interesting topic. My question, though, goes to directly to the author, and that is, given that your mother committed suicide, did you ever have any fear that you would have tendencies of suicide?
That's a very direct and honest question. And in Chapter 2, my daughter actually asked me that question when she was about 10 years old. And I told her, no, I would never kill myself. And I can say that with confidence. I certainly worried when I was younger that I could get depressed, and worried that, you know, that they talk about with trauma that you can have what's called a foreshortened sense of future. So I was very relieved when I made it past 33 years old, and really now I'm 17 years older than my mother, and each year keeps getting better and better. So I also did a lot of thought, and I think any of us who have depression in our families or alcoholism or suicide, probably all of us should think about self-care and how do we preserve our sense of joy and stamina. So I've put a lot of thought into that.
Thank
and
you.
Writing certainly was one way.
Thanks.
Reading.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was saying writing. For me, it's writing, reading, yoga, running, having a wonderful family. That gives me enormous strength.
Yeah. There you quote from a lot of literature in the book. How has that given you strength?
I was an English major in college, and that was a big decision to do that, since there were a lot of people who were going pre-med who who were doing the sciences. And I've always loved the world of writers. I mean, a good writer can bring, and certainly what I was trying to do was create a character that you can learn from and care about and be wiser after reading it. So that's, you know, that was my intent, and that's the joy I get from reading a great book.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Nancy Rappaport. She's a child psychiatrist, and she's the author of In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments. 333-9455 is the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you have five siblings, Martha, Amy, Judy, Jim, and Jerry. How have the six of you talked about this in recent years, your mother's death?
Well, we all talked about it differently, and I think that's an important take-home message about the fact that family members do cope differently. And that was one of the most positive unintended consequences of me writing this memoir. My oldest sister is terrific. She's 9 years older than me. And I really wasn't that close with her growing up because she left to go off to college when I was in, you know, fourth grade. And she when I had those kind of conversations with her now as a child psychiatrist, I came back, I said, you know, look, Martha, I'm writing this book. She was so generous with me. And she sent me, she had kept over the years the trip across the country that we had done when I was about six, and all the kids had written a journal. And at that time, we had a blended family of 9 or 10 kids, and that's 3 or 4 pages in the memoir. And she talked about what her experience was having my mother kill herself 4 days before her 12th birthday. And these were things we never talked about growing up. And, you know, my other brother, Jim, has been, he's into politics and has really helped me with how you do talk with media. How do you have some kind of privacy at the same time as I've been remarkably open. And he's incredibly meticulous about detail, so he combed through my memoir for facts. So in some ways, that was the surprise, that in a way, my memoir became also a shared experience with my brothers and sisters in a way that we never really had done that around the loss of my mother. So I've been very blessed that way.
And your father?
My dad, I hope all you readers who read this realize that he is a hero in this story. And he was, certainly this would not have been his top topic for his daughter at 50 years old to write, to resurrect my mother 45 years later. And yet he said to me in the interview I have in the last chapter, you know, never allow the child to define the relationship. And what I meant by that is there were times when I was growing up where I would withdraw from him out of fear that maybe he was so powerful that, you know, when we talk about suicide demands and explanation, maybe he caused it if he hadn't been so tough in the custody battle. And to be able to talk in a way openly and have his support is a testament to the kind of depth of commitment he gave to our family over the years that I've, you know, 50, he's got remarkably successful kids, if I don't sound self-congratulatory. And he has what we see in the research, which is a lot of times how well children of suicide, of a parent's suicide do, is how well the surviving parent does. And he is a lesson in endurance and care for his kids. You know, complicated character, but...
Yeah.
We all are. I learn that more and more as a parent. I mean, gosh, God forbid if one of my kids writes a memoir about me. You never know what they'll remember.
I think it'll be fine. I wouldn't worry about it. Don't lose any sleep over it.
Thank you. Appreciate that, Celeste.
How should parents guide kids through a sudden loss of a loved one? in particular in the case of suicide?
What's most important is to be present and to be open to what they may feel. And particularly sometimes with teenagers, they can be sort of inappropriate. Maybe they'll laugh about, be irreverent, be withdrawn. And you just want to be able to tolerate the how they may show their confusion. And then make sure to communicate that nothing they did or said caused their parent to kill themselves. Because even if they look at you as if, of course, they never thought about that, many kids will worry that it's something that they did. And the other aspect is to stay strong and care for yourself, because they're going to read your cues. And if you're able to be good to yourself, it'll allow themselves to be able to do the same thing. And we really didn't do this much growing up, and it was partly because of the confusion around the divorce happening. But I think it's important to share memories and photos of the parent, and if during the holiday, having some kind of ritual that allows them to keep a connection, whether it's putting a Christmas ornament or lighting a candle for Hanukkah, that somehow says, important thing for me that I find comfort in is that love lasts longer than death. And that we can carry a sense of who that person is despite them being gone. And the other thing is, I think it's a little bit like, you know, when you have as a parent talk about sex and you kind of think, okay, I'm going to have this one perfect talk. And you want to be forgiving of yourself about it doesn't have to be perfect. And really you want to be open to having a dialogue over time. And that's the part that you want to be able to communicate.
Yeah. Also, that teaches a lesson about compassion, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know. And I guess the other thing would be modeling that there may be times that you feel overwhelmed, but that you can go on. And that's another one that's important.
Yeah. When we think of loss here, we've talked a little bit about we've talked a lot about loss of life, but divorce can also be felt as loss in the lives of children. Going back to this idea of family scaffolding, how does divorce complicate a family scaffolding, and how do you make certain that these children, if your marriage is coming apart, feel secure?
I love that question, because one of the aspects that all of us can take about with families is when you have triangles, which are when you have parents, say, talking to each other through the kid, that can be remarkably destabilizing. And of course, there's ample opportunity to do that with a divorce, where the kid is, you know, classically caught in the middle. And that is incredibly toxic for kids. When I've done school consultations, one of the places you really see kids show poor motivation is when there's been a high conflict divorce and the kid just stops being able to function in a way that's productive. So I would really encourage any of your listeners who are involved with a divorce to think about the higher good, which is that they love their children, and try to find a way to resolve conflict that doesn't put their kids in the middle. That's one thing. The other thing is just what I was talking about with a meaningful narrative in terms of suicide. In divorce, kids are left wondering, what does this mean? And sometimes they can blame themselves, or they can be perplexed because it looked to them as if there was no problem in the relationship. So that's another aspect of trying to build some kind of explanation that can help kids move on. And the other last thing I would say is trying to do the rituals with kids and the routines that can reassure them. And that's something you want to do in any kind of crisis. You know, after 9/11, you know, school stayed open the next day because they want to reassure kids that some things have changed and some things haven't. And the parts that haven't changed can be remarkably comforting to kids.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Hi there. And first of all, I want to make a comment, and then I have a question. My comment is I thank you so much for having this show today, and I'm so thankful that you survived all that you have gone through. My question is, any age, whether it be young or much older like myself, is there such a thing as a person being so worn out and weary of physical pain and emotional pain and all of the things that happen to us along this journey that they just get so weary that they think that death is the only answer? And I'll hang up and listen. And again, thank you very much.
You are remarkably kind to me. I appreciate that. It makes me want to make sure to just let anybody who is feeling very bleak to know that there is a 1-800-273-TALK, which is a lifeline number. And, you know, I use a epigram in one of the chapters called, it's by Galway Canal, it's called Wait. It's a beautiful poem that's a wait for now, distrust everything if you have to. The need for new love is faithfulness to the old. And that aspect of being so worn out and tired, my mother talks about that, death being a change in degrees, and I think she had felt like she had fought a custody battle for 2 years, and there are probably other multiple things that I talk about in the book that made her feel discouraged. And certainly what you're talking about is so true in depression, which is that people think that nothing is ever going to change and that there is a permanence to their despair. And some people talk about that suicide is a permanent answer to a temporary problem. And that's the mission that you try to communicate, is we don't know the changes that may happen that will fortify us. And, you know, getting help to figure out what those alternatives are that make life feel worth living is something I would ask all your listeners to do.
Yeah. Let's give that number again. It's 1-800-273-TALK.
Yes.
And with this prevention lifeline, you'll be connected to a crisis center. Now, give us an idea. Somebody maybe is feeling really desperate, hopeless. When you pick up the phone and make a call like this, what happens?
You know, I have to try it because I have, I can tell you a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, it depends actually where you call. There are some crisis lifelines the Samaritans, for instance, where they are anonymous calls. So they befriend you and have a discussion about what your feelings are, but they won't send out an ambulance if they really think you're imminently about to harm yourself. And then there are other crisis centers that will really, if they think it's imminent, they might intervene in a way that... So that's where I'm sort of hedging. But the other aspect is that... Say you went into an emergency room. Let's just take it not going. You may come in and say, you know, I was thinking about hanging myself. And they'll assess, is this something that's going to happen? You know, is there anything that we assess about this that makes it feel that you can be seen outpatient to get the kind of treatment that you need? Or do you need some time in a hospital for us to get a sense of what happened? So if there's a sudden change in mood, or say someone is psychotic, you know, 10% of which psychotic means that your mind's playing tricks on you and you're hearing voices, that's something where if you, you know, became psychotic, you're 17, 18 years old, you're having your first psychotic break, and you're suicidal, you'd want to be in the hospital to try to sort that out.
Yeah.
There are other times where you may be overwhelmed and say, I'm thinking about killing myself, but I know I'm not going to do it. And then someone would help you get more resources to be able to talk. And then, you know, there are American Foundation of Suicide Prevention. Say you were feeling horrible about the loss of someone that had killed themselves. They have access around the country to being able to go to support groups where you can talk to other people who have lost someone they love.
Yeah. There's a lot of help out there. And a few years ago, I had occasion to be in a family situation with someone hospitalized. And I was so impressed with the people who were there, who were on staff, and the patients and the families of the patients. It was, I was so afraid of it.
Yes.
And it was okay.
Yeah. I'm glad you had a positive experience.
Yeah, I'm sure you can have a bad experience too, but it was good. So.
Well, having family members that advocate and don't leave your side can be enormously useful. Mm. So don't underestimate the role of family in helping a suicidal patient. Mm.
Dr. Rappaport, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
It's been a joy, and I'd love to hear from any of your listeners who do read my book. They can contact me through the website, innerwake.com.
Okay, very good. Dr. Nancy Rappaport, she is the author of In Her Wake, A Child Psychiatrist Explores the Mystery of Her Mother's Suicide. The book is published by Basic Books.